So tonight, continuing with our foundational teachings series, and this is the fifth and final class on the five hindrances. So the five hindrances are a teaching by the Buddha on, you know, five things that hinder us on our spiritual path, or they're hindrances as we're trying to walk the Eightfold Path, or relieve suffering, or cultivate wisdom. So they are worldly obsession or sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor. As we covered in our past classes, it's a hyphenated sloth being kind of laziness, and torpor being the kind of sluggishness of mind and body that result from that, and then it's a feedback loop there, so sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness and worry. So they're both kind of a agitated state. And uncertainty or skeptical doubt, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. And just to review, there's some neat metaphors for each of these hindrances that kind of give you a sense of how they hinder us. So one metaphor is that there is a pail of water, and we want to be able to like see our reflection in it. So when we have the hindrance of worldly obsession or sensual desire is present, the water is made opaque with dyes and other substances. When we're affected by ill will, the water is boiling. When we have sloth and torpor, the water is covered over with algae and slime. When we're affected by restlessness and worry, the water is ruffled by the wind. And when we're affected by uncertainty or skeptical doubt, it's turbid from being stirred up as if there was mud in the water, and or it's kind of two different images, or the whole pail is hidden in the dark. And then the other metaphor is, if you're affected by worldly obsession or sensual desire, it's like enjoying things while incurring debt you'll later have to pay, often with interest and some form of suffering. Ill will is like a sick person, or just as a sick person who can't enjoy physical ease and good health, an angry person can't enjoy spiritual ease and joy. With sloth and torpor, it's like being stuck in a cramped, dark prison. Restlessness and worry, it's like being constantly at the beck and call of someone else. And with skeptical doubt, it's like we're traveling in a desert and we've become lost and have no map. So Tenisiro Bhikkhu explains a little further. These hindrances need to be abandoned because they function as intermediate levels of the three roots of unskillfulness. Sensual desire is a form of greed. Ill will, a form of aversion. So there's the three poisons are greed, hate, and delusion. Ill will is obviously hate or aversion. The remaining three hindrances are forms of delusion. So sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt are all in the delusion category. In early Buddhism, there's just tons of lists. So the Eightfold Path and the last spoke on the Eightfold Path is the Four Noble Truths, and then you got the three poisons in there, and so they all kind of line up in a fractal kind of way. So the three poisons also correspond to the five hindrances. All five, in their various ways, block concentration and weaken discernment by making it difficult to realize what is beneficial for oneself, for others, or for both. So, skeptical doubt, the Pali term is vichikicca. I looked it up on Forvo today to find out how to say it. I'm sure I'm not saying it very well, but vichikicca. And Bhikkhu Bodhi says, doubt, or vichikicca, doubt here signifies spiritual doubt. From a Buddhist perspective, the inability to place confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and the training. Its characteristic is doubting. Its function is to waver. It is manifested as indecisiveness and as taking various sides. Its proximate cause is unwise attention. So before we brainstorm about this kind of doubt and how it manifests in our lives, I want to say there's two kinds of doubt this is not. So this is not wholesome, responsible questioning. As you encounter something and you go, so what's that about? I'm not sure you understand that yet. You know, because the Buddha was very clear that we are supposed to explore and verify the teachings for ourselves. So that kind of investigative doubt is you know, not this hindrance. And it's also with another kind of doubt in our practice, which this is not a hindrance, which we call the great doubt. So there's three, another list, three pillars of our practice: great faith, great doubt, and great determination. So it said we need all of these to really have a lively practice. And the great doubt in that sense is really, you know, our deepest questions. What is life about? You know, who am I? You know, how do I open up to love, or how do I let go of my fears or something? But all of those kinds of questions end up, they say it's like they all doubts end up being one. There's a kind of, if we explore deeply enough, all of those deep questions end up coming down to what they say is like a doubt mass. And doubt mass, like they're just kind of boiled down to a kind of nameless, wordless question, you know, like what is this? And that without that kind of curiosity, without that kind of, and kind of not just kind of removed intellectual curiosity, but like a kind of a life and death matter curiosity, you know, we're not going to be terribly motivated to explore spiritual practice. But then we also need the great faith, which is really, that is, would be a good remedy for this, for the hindrance of skeptical doubt, and then great determination as well. So wholesome, responsible questioning, cool. You know, great doubt, cool. Skeptical doubt is something different. So skeptical or uncertain doubt. So basically, when doubt becomes a hindrance, how does it manifest? And I thought, as I'm writing these things, we can describe how it manifests, but also maybe questions that takes the form of. So, when doubt becomes a hindrance, doubt becomes difficult, or uncertainty.
Well, if you have so much doubt or uncertainty that you simply can't make a step forward.
It's paralyzing.
Yeah.
It could lead you to like sloth and just being lazy.
Yeah, so in action maybe.
What's the question again? When doubt,
so you know, how does this hindrance manifest? anxiety. Because just to discern the different hindrances from each other, we did restlessness and worry last week, so this is like, somehow this is different. I mean, I'm sure that they can all feed into each other.
Lack of trust? Is it fearful?
Mark has one.
I've been read it out. I'm still struggling to figure out how to put it, but there's the not knowing that is applauded in Zen, but then there's a kind of not knowing that is just refusing to know. Like yeah. Obstinately refusing to admit to something that you actually know.
Well, and I would add to that, can it manifest itself as aversion?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, aversion is its own... Well, that's a good question, because I mean, ill will, the way that we discussed it as a hindrance, is really and primarily ill will toward beings, toward people, or yourself. I mean, so I suppose there could be... What would you be averse to in this case?
Well, here's what, it comes from an example where I was trying to do a manga, and I was not doing very well, but I believed what I was saying. And so I called it bullshit. And so I think that was a manifestation of a lot of doubt and a lot of this is stupid. So that's where that comes from.
Some kind of rejection. Maybe, or...
Yeah, that's a good one. Rejection.
Or negativity.
I mean, there is sometimes in people in conversations, is it this? No, that's not it. Is it this? No, that's not it. It's not that. But you never get anywhere because you just know it's not that.
Is that wavering?
Or like somebody, like, or something that's constantly shooting everything down.
Yes.
You just have doubt in everything. You're not
yes.
willing to even get past the, like, consideration
yeah.
part.
Yeah. Lack of openness.
Or the inability to look past the question itself.
Huh. Or believing in delusion. Doubting the concept of delusion to the point where you believe in your worldview is correct. I'm not sure that's quite right, but it's there somewhere.
It's single-mindedness.
Yeah.
Narrow-minded.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to state it, but I think it's close.
Kind of, attached to your view.
The defensive skeptical doubt of the climate change denier.
Maybe kind of defensiveness.
Willfulness. 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 Stop it.
About your
life and or dig your heels in. Another word.
Applauding hopelessness. You know, I mean, kind of wallowing in it, promoting it.
Uncertainty.
Flip side of attach your own views is dismissal of other views or other paths.
Well, I think it's an inability to be open to belief. Because it's a lack of faith.
Which brings me to, you know, what is underneath that kind of thing of not being able to have faith or believe or be open-minded?
Fear. Is it fear?
Homelessness. And then what is the fear under?
Rejection?
Fear of not being seen or heard or recognized?
Scared of life, honest.
Scared of failing.
Fear of not being loved.
Fear of being fooled.
Being fooled, unlovable, maybe once you're
not
seen.
Valued, you know, not valued, yeah.
Unworthy.
I would say also a fear of disappointment. Maybe you kind of hope or trust, and then it all just falls apart. Then you've kind of made yourself vulnerable. It's a little trickier one to neatly define than some of the other ones, but. I mean, when you are, you know, what maybe, maybe we can put in terms of questions, like how
in your life, and particularly maybe because he's saying this is about spiritual doubt, so particularly around your practice, around Buddhism, or around meditation, or whatever, you know, how does your doubt manifest, not so much in terms of emotions, but in terms of like what words does it take? What, you know, what is the doubt?
Well, nothing's going to happen today and I don't have time, so I'm going to skip meditation. That's the way it manifests for me.
So that would be a doubt that this is helpful, or that you're going to achieve anything, or
doubt that I'll ever be enlightened.
Oh. But we live in a world where we want to see results, so it would be easy for NA practitioner to say, well, what's the point, or what am I gaining from it immediately or right now?
Yeah, is this worth my time? So many other things I could be doing.
Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Not just to me, but
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you show up, you know, at a Zen center, and you know, you're essentially told if you do this and that, it's really good, and here's these teachings, and there's kind of an implication, right, that this is going to be rewarding somehow, and, you know, should you believe it? You know, at a certain point, I think I was really proud when I got into Buddhism because I had found this spiritual practice that didn't require you to believe in anything. And, you know, unlike those other people who have those, you know, spiritual phase where they have to like just believe something, you know, and I don't know, at a certain point I was sitting in a class like this and listening to whoever was presenting, and all of a sudden I was like, you know, I really have no idea what they're talking about. I just hope that it's true. Like, I'm taking a lot of this on faith because they seem like decent people, and you know, but I realized, oh no, I'm taking a lot of this on faith. Like, this really isn't different. I mean, I like to think that the good thing about Buddhism is it says you can and should verify each of these things for yourself. That you shouldn't just, you know, blind faith accept whatever. But at a certain point, it's like, that's why we have the great faith and great doubt are like two steps in walking, because we do have to go some distance down the path in order to verify it for yourself. If you just, you know, sit and I don't know. Like, you're not going to be able to verify it for yourself. So there has to be a little bit of faith, like provisional faith or whatever, temporary faith.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you earlier when you said that, what does it look like to verify these things for ourselves? But for me, I go with, you know, assuming I can sense a level of goodness. You know, if the Buddha said it, and Bodhidharma said it, and whoever wrote the Heart Sutra said it, and, you know, the Chinese ancestor said it, and Dogen says it, and you say it, and Gyokuko says it, and Shinzai says it, I mean, you can't believe in some of that? I mean, that's the way I look at it. And I don't have a problem with that.
It's helpful. I think that that's part of the reason that we do establish and verify lineage in a way, is throughout history that's been like, you know, look, like we can, you know, trace this through time. I didn't make it up, you know, in some sense that can help our faith. The fact that this has been around for a while and it's been verified again and again. And also, like, hopefully you just meet people that, I've never met anyone that I think, oh my God, they're just permanently enlightened. They're just walking around like a saint on a cloud. I have not for myself personally verified that such a person can exist. And I don't care, because I've certainly met people that are much more present and compassionate and aware and much, much more than I am. So I don't worry that there's perfection whether perfection is possible. I know much more is possible. So maybe I'm seeing somebody perfectly enlightened, but I'm certainly seeing people that make me, I want that. I want to be more like them. And how did you do that? So, other doubts that arise on our spiritual path, early or later?
The doubt that the self is an illusion. That it's something that's difficult to overcome to begin with. It's the cling to it and sort of flavors the whole practice to begin with.
Mm.
But it's just me, and that's what's important. You know, who else do I rely on? Who was here when I was born? Who's going to be here when I die? Myself, that's important. And letting go of that. Or learning to start to let go of that,
yeah.
I should say, is a step away from skeptical doubt. Into faith.
Yeah, I guess I would describe that as like, you know, when we're being asked to let go and, you know, to really verify certain teachings for ourselves, whatever, there's a little part of us sitting over there with a skeptical doubt, like, you need me, you know. Yeah, sure, fine. Or like, you really need me to awaken and then we'll be really cool. Don't let go of me. You nearly need me.
Well, Pima children have been told by people, well, I'll come and meet you when I become a better practitioner and get my act together. She said, don't wait, because I'm still working on it for herself.
You know, for, I think, when certain doubts, you know, you come into a community or you come into a practice and you're like, how effective is this? You know, looking around at these other practitioners, you know, does it seem to have helped them? You know, these healthy kind of questioning things. And at what point does that become a hindrance, you know, essentially keeping you in paralysis, unable to commit, fearful? I mean, I think that's when we're just preoccupied by those thoughts, right? And constantly second guessing. So it's kind of a middle way thing, right? You know, I mean, we need to ask some of these questions. And sometimes, as we all know, blind faith has led to lots of awful things, particularly within spiritual communities, where you just said, oh, you know, it's the enlightened guru, everything they do is great. And then, ugh. So we still want to have our wits about us. But I know I wasted a ton of time on the meditation cushion and off, thinking, is this the right path? Is this the fastest path? Is this the right teacher? Is this the right sangha? Is this the right, do I need to be in a monastery? I don't think I can do it here. You know, and is there a path somewhere? You know, sometimes this is just so hard to understand, and it's so hard to meditate right and everything. Maybe is there another path that's just easier to understand that would just, you know, click with me better and would just, you know, resonate with me and not rub me all the wrong ways the way this one does? Like, at a certain point when we're thinking about that kind of thing all the time, and I noticed when I was doing that, so I really, really, in my early monastic years, I really, really wanted to be in a monastery. And my teacher, Gyokoko, was at Dharma Rain Zen Center, which is just a late practice temple over in southeast Portland. And sure, we had a few residents, but mostly it was just like this place, except there were a couple of people who lived here. And we had meals together, so it was not a monastery. But I got to go away to Tassajara Zen Monastery for a 3-month practice period. And then I stayed the summer to work to pay off that practice period. And by the end of my time at Tassajara, I'm like, there's got to be a better monastery. I liked the practice period time when you're cloistered and you're just meditating and studying. But then you have this stupid time in the summertime when all these guests come and you have to take care of them, and like, it's just a waste of time, you know. So it's like nothing, it's like, wait a second. You know, just, I could spend my whole life looking right for the perfect place, and that's the whole point. So we don't need a perfect venue to practice. So I talked about how do we tell a valid doubt has become a hindrance? I mean, does anybody else want to share instances of, recognizing when, okay, you know, it's at some level it might be a valid doubt, but now it's time to just kind of let it go and maybe take a risk or dive in.
I think when it's contributing to other hindrances, like restlessness or worry, you know, expand.
Mm-hmm. Or sloth and torpor, like you said earlier. Or ill will, aversion, yeah. Or desire for the cooler, better practice. It's not central desire exactly, but it's still kind of that obsession. Yeah, that's a good point.
I have to say that in my relationship, I think there was a period of time where it was like, well, it's not perfect. I have doubts about one insignificant thing, and love is supposed to be overwhelmingly beautiful and perfect. Like, how can I move forward from this? And you have to just, like, stop and be like, okay, it's not perfect. But can we get through the imperfections together?
And that's where the aspect of the hindrances where it's like self-perpetuating. So it says the what feeds the hindrance of skeptical doubt is dwelling on the subject of your doubt, right? So it's dwelling on that. And then if we can be mindful, like, oh, okay, you know, this hindrance of skeptical doubt has arisen, that's a very different relationship to it. That's shifting your attention to the experience of the hindrance as opposed to that, oh no, you know, because there's really no, we've all done that, right? There's no list of pros and cons that are going to solve it for you. It's just, that's not what it's about. It's like, when I was getting into my current relationship, I had, you know, like, oh man, all these like dysfunctional things. It's just like my last relationship. I said I wasn't gonna do that again. Oh no, it was kind of like, oh my god, oh no, this is terrible. And I asked my teacher, I was telling her about it, and she said, well, does anything that he does or that about the relationship make it just unworkable for you? And I was like, no. She's like, there you go. And I was just like, what? Like, that's just a totally different way to look at it, you know?
You're better here and now than you were back then. That's one of the ways to look at it. So incremental. I mean, like you say, you don't necessarily gain anything by sitting and meditating. You're doing it.
Yeah.
And so I guess you have to. While the self may be a delusion, you still remember yourself when you started, and yourself 5 years ago, of 10 years ago, and the changes and what is happening. It has effect. 10 years of meditation has not changed you. And it probably wasn't worth it, but I think most of us would agree that it has been worth it. This journey.
Yeah, we may not find what we set out looking for, but that's like part of the process, right? Like our ideas about how things should happen. Morph and change. Huh. So, in terms of, I don't know if this is going to be a very fruitful question, but so we don't want to just have blind faith, but how do we summon faith, I guess. How do we, are there any practices or ways of shifting our own minds that let us, you know, cultivate a little bit of faith in order to be able to move forward?
I'm not sure if this is what you're asking, but when you said the thing about, oh, I've been on this path before, I said I wasn't going to do this to myself again, returning to those issues.
I've had the same exact thoughts with work and relationships and everything, and then most recently I was like, well, is it the other person's fault? Or am I just finding this one thing really irritating? Or is, like, why is this triggering this anger? Is it really this person? And then shifting my doubt to a different thing rather than this other person's fault, but why do I feel this doubt?
Yeah.
Doubting myself instead or some other thing.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, and I think in a way that's that mindfulness of whether you called it skeptical doubt or whatever, you're recognizing some patterns arising, and you're shifting your attention to that instead of to like that.
Like one easy thing to do is just talk to somebody else. It's really easy to get stuck in your doubt, get in that loop, and then you can talk to someone and say, no, you're being weird and crazy.
Yeah.
It's more like this, not like that.
Which is part of one of the mindfulness of the of the hindrance, and then one of the things is noble friendship and suitable conversation. Just it made me think of, like, you know, who do we, when we're feeling these doubts, you know, there's also something involved in, like, who do we seek out in order to process them with, you know. We kind of notice, like, you know, am I going to pick that person who's just going to, like, feed my doubt? Or am I going to pick that person who's going to say, and if nothing else, just not jump on the bandwagon with you, so then you kind of get a little perspective. But sometimes it's really tempting to go for that friend that's going to be like, yeah. It's such a crazy cult. You shouldn't be going there.
Kind of ask myself, in the case of lack of trust, what would it really cost to trust? Because you can just sort of get locked up behind the fear, and looking at the consequences can actually clarify quite a bit.
So that's one of the ones that it says in the classic Buddhist texts. I would categorize that as the contemplating the effects of not abandoning the hindrance. If I don't abandon this hindrance, what's the likely outcome? And I had a friend who pointed out, who I think struggles with this a fair amount, and she said, she didn't want it to be written on her gravestone. She kept her options open. You know, it always seems good from this point of view. Well, but ultimately, is that what we really want, you know?
Can you repeat the thing just before that part of the discussion about, we were talking about talking with others, and there was something that you read from about wholesome conversation or right relationships or something.
One of the antidotes to any of the hindrances is noble friendship and suitable conversation. And they're like two separate antidotes, I guess. I mean, obviously they can come together as well.
You asked about blind faith, and it seems to be kind of hard to conceive that for anyone for any length of time following the Buddhist practice, because you may endure with blind faith, and they're like, do this and become enlightened to all this, but if you keep doing it, at some point in your practice, you're going to start realizing those delusions, and that blind faith, that faith is one of the delusions. So if you actually start that way and keep at it, it will drop away.
I like to think that our practice is, you know, constructed to deconstruct delusions. Like, even if you go into it for all the wrong reasons, you know, and you're just ready to just absorb it all and not question it. Like, just the practice itself is going to get you starting to question it.
It's hard to spend that much time just by yourself, which is really, even though we're together, we are just by ourselves as well, without gaining insight into that.
Yeah. Let's see. And to some extent, as Junri pointed out, I think last time, I mean, the hindrances are what they arise, you know, in a relative sense. There's something that arises in our mind and body, and we can respond to skillfully or unskillfully. There's things we can do to recognize them and decrease them as opposed to feed them and whatever. But kind of at the, you know, underneath them all is self-concern. Underneath them all is the delusion that there is a small, separate, inherently existing self that needs stuff or could be threatened or, you know, that we're worried about in these various ways. So ideally our practice helps us. And I think sometimes it may sound in Buddhism like we're saying, you know, we have this delusion of that the self exists in this hard way. And if you practice long enough, you know, then you might, you know, wake up and see that it doesn't, as if it's like just this black or white thing. But I think it's like our sense of self can soften. We can become less attached to it. We can become more ready to just go, meh, sure seems real, but, you know, I don't know. I think I can just kind of let this go or slide and see what happens. And then oftentimes we see actually it's fine. It feels much better if we're not trying to hold on to and protect ourselves. So yeah, I think it can be, it's really more of a spectrum in terms of how attached we are to ourselves and how defensive we are about ourselves. So the less we can be that way, the more we can soften, then I think the easier it is to drop these hindrances as well. People, does that sound?
Getting unstuck.
Yeah. So when people if you can think of a time when you were stuck in one of these hindrances, desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, or skeptical doubt, I mean, think of a time when one way or another you managed to we call it abandoning the hindrance, but like just letting go, turning away, mitigating it, whatever. Can you think of that time and how it made you feel about yourself? Because I feel like these are different kinds of self-attachment, and when we're caught up in them, it seems like a life or death matter. Like if you let go of that, well, what is reality anyway? Who are you? You can just be really mad and then just let it go. Like it just. For the self, it's crazy making, right? Or desire, something you gotta have. or sloth and torpor when you're just, I am feeling this way. But somehow you just make yourself get up and go get some exercise. Who's doing that? Who made that decision? And when you feel better, what?
I was going to say, in the midst of restlessness and worry, if you find the door out of it, there's a kind of a tenderness there, because you realize that the thing that you're worried about feels more real because you were worrying about it. and there's this moment where you're like, you really are just trying to make it better, and you're using all the wrong tools. You poor thing. Here, just stop. But there's a tenderness there, at least with that one.
I remember a time when I had a lot of ill will towards somebody who really wronged me, and right around the same time I started this yoga class that ended with a metta practice, and I was like, wow, I really don't want to do this. I really don't. I was like kind of grumpy and wanted to like just opt out and like space out for the last little bit of class. And just after a while, I was like, man, I don't have any ill will towards this person anymore, but all of a sudden, I just felt all pain from it. It didn't feel good, but I allowed myself to feel the pain and to feel really gross and stuff about it. And it was interesting. I wouldn't say that I felt better. I didn't have any ill will, but I allowed myself to feel what I think I was putting off. I'm strong and didn't actually.
Interesting. So then, I mean, the ill will was a hindrance to kind of what needed to happen.
Well, this doesn't have to be a permanent. It's always changing. Mm-hmm. So we sit with it. Go to the cushion.
Well, in our precepts we say ill will or anger is contriving reality for the self. So that's my biggest, I feel like when we abandon the hindrance. So on the one hand, you could say you could give up self-attachment and then it gets easier to abandon a hindrance. But the beautiful thing about our practice is it all just kind of works together, right? So when we abandon a hindrance, I feel like we experience a moment of no self. We experience a moment of letting go of that sense of reality that the self has built. So I don't generally get angry at people. I get angry at situations and things and doorknobs and stoplights and stuff like that, which is probably like, you know, redirecting anger. But I did end up getting really angry at something my Dharma brother did. I just thought it was just, you know, bordering on Buddhist sacrilege, and I was just furious. And I was in a setting where I was surrounded by people and I needed to, like, I don't know, like give a little talk or something like that. So I needed to like get over it, at least temporarily. And I just didn't think it was possible, but I went out and I just took a walk. You know, I just took a walk and, you know, reminded myself, like, okay, you know, what's the actual situation here? It's not an emergency, right? This is something that has been going on for quite a while. Okay. And it was like, it was so weird. It was so weird to let that ill will go. It was part of myself at that point. It was part of my self, you know, constructed reality. And to just let go of it really makes you question, is the self really what you think it is? Is it as permanent or real as we think? Or is it really pretty fluid? Well, I'll end with, some of you might have heard this before, but this is a poem I have had written because I held on to my skepticism for a pretty long time in practice. I mean, yes and no, you know, faith, hope, skepticism, I don't know. But I think somebody had said, you know, fearful of being fooled, fearful of being wrong, fearful of, you know, putting all my eggs in this basket and then just, like, it actually is BS. And, you know, that would be really disappointing, amongst other things. So this is skeptic. You say, I cannot have faith until I have proof. But you never find the proof until you have faith. Question anything of real importance, God, enlightenment, magic, the fundamental goodness of the human heart, and the incontestable evidence is invisible to the skeptic. You say, then this evidence is merely delusion conjured up by a wishful thinking. But those who have proven it to themselves know this is not the case. They dance with exuberance, free from doubt. You say, they're dancing because they put blinders on and ignore the dismal and dreary truth. But while they're dancing, what are you doing? And with that, thank you all for coming.